There's so much to look forward to in 2026 on the ABC.
Yes. Phenomenal.
Just you wait.
With new drama, Goolagong.
She's a natural.
Brand new dog park.
It's a shame we can't be more like them, isn't it?
I'm happy with a handshake.
A new take on a 90s classic.
Welcome to Race Around the World.
And new seasons of old favourites, like Austin, The Piano.
Give me more of that.
Grand Designs Transformations and Muster Dogs.
This brings things into focus, doesn't it?
This is fabulous.
So much to look forward to.
That's 2026.
It's a spectacular time.
On ABC TV and ABC iView.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Lexi Junowick, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, bushfires continue to burn in Victoria after a deadly weekend, with almost 400,000 hectares burnt and hundreds of structures razed. You'll hear from the Victorian Emergency Services Minister, who's warning the danger is far from over.
After Black Saturday, there is a story of within 40 minutes of a road being opened, a tree falling down on a car. We do not want to see those kind of incidents.
Also coming up, protests spread across Iran amid calls for a full-scale people's revolt. We'll have expert analysis.
I think what's driving people is just an overarching sense that the regime has no answer for any of the existential problems that are facing the country.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Favourable conditions in Victoria today should help firefighters who spent the weekend battling devastating blazes across the state. Some 390,000 hectares have been scorched, with dozens of homes lost. And yesterday, Victoria Police confirmed the remains of a person were found in the Longwood bushfire area, around 100 metres from a vehicle. For more, host Jade McMillan spoke with Vicky Ward, Victoria's Minister for Emergency Services and Natural Disaster Recovery.
Is there any more information you can provide about the person who died in the Longwood bushfire area?
No, that's still under investigation with Victoria Police, and I'll wait for them to offer more information to the public. But it is certainly really awful circumstances, and I really feel for that family in such a stressful situation. To continue to have such devastating news is just horrible.
Are there concerns that any other lives may have been lost at this stage?
We haven't had any notification of anybody who is, where their whereabouts are unknown. So we'll continue to monitor the situation, but at the moment that's the only one we're aware of.
Is there an update, Minister, on how many homes have now been lost across Victoria?
Yeah, we know that there's over 300 structure losses. Now, that will include sheds as well as homes. It's scattered across the various fires. We've had so many fires in this state. It's around 60 fires in the northeast, in the Longwood fire. And it's various homes around the state. We're looking at probably at least 100 homes overall, if not more, being lost.
This is such a difficult time for so many people in Victoria who've been affected by these fires. What immediate financial support can they claim?
Thank you. There's a couple of options for people which is important for them to know about. And they can go to the recovery centres. We've got 11 recovery centres in the state where people will be able to help them. But, of course, they can jump online and use the phone. So there is a payment that the state government has set up in assistance, which is the personal hardship assistance, which is $340 for children, $680 for adults, maximum of $2,380 for families. And there is also a federal government disaster relief payment, which is $1,000 per eligible adult and $400 per child.
Minister, many communities reported power blackouts and loss of mobile reception during this disaster. What is being done to address those issues?
Yeah, the power agencies are working incredibly quickly. They have been located within the incident control centres, which has been really important, which has meant that we've been able to have real-time information move around the state. So they are working where it is safe to do so to ensure that they are connecting power wherever possible. I understand that in Harcourt, for example, it's anticipated that power will be back on today.
Over the weekend, the Victorian Police Chief Commissioner Mike Bush criticised the actions of some people who he said had ignored instructions at roadblocks. What more can you tell us about that?
So it's really important that people do not go into the fire scar area. Where there are roadblocks, they're there for a reason, and that is to keep people safe, as well as to protect what is in that community as well. So it's not just the trees that have fallen over across roadsides. It's the trees we don't know about that is the biggest risk. There are trees that fall down, and they can fall down unexpectedly. And we need to have people go in, qualified people who know what they're doing, going in there to check, to make sure that roadways are safe, because trees can just fall on people. We know that after Black Saturday, there is a story of within 40 minutes of a road being opened, a tree falling down on a car. We do not want to see those kind of incidents. We do not want to see people who have done the right thing, who have left early, who have saved their lives, the lives of their families, then go back into a fire area only to be harmed, possibly killed by a falling tree. We also, as you've indicated, don't have power in all of these areas. We don't have water necessarily in all of these areas. They're just not safe to go into.
And what about this issue of so-called bushfire tourists? Authorities have criticised people that they've said have travelled into these areas to see the damage.
Look, it's outrageous. I cannot fathom how somebody would think it is okay to go and be a witness to this horrible tragedy that has occurred to so many people. You just keep out. Just keep out. Please respect what these people have gone through. Please give them the time to process what they've gone through. Give them the time to actually see what the effects have been of this fire on their home, on their community, on their neighbours. To go in there and see this as an opportunity to have a sticky beak, it's just wrong. It's despicable behaviour, and people should not be doing it. It is not safe, and it is incredibly disrespectful.
I appreciate it's still the early stages of this disaster, but what lessons will you and the government more broadly be looking at from these fires in terms of trying to prevent future blazes that are as damaging as these?
Well, every fire has an investigation, every fire has a review, and of course there will always be learnings from this, as there is from every disaster. But I think we need to be really clear. We had catastrophic conditions on Friday. We warned the community and the community listened and people left. We know that there has been loss of livelihoods. We know that, farms have gone up, orchards have been lost, vineyards have been lost, livestock has been lost. When you have catastrophic conditions like this, you cannot prevent the fire. You cannot prevent lightning. You cannot prevent wind. What you can do is do all the preparation that you can to help reduce the harm of that fire. And that's exactly what Victorians did. That's what our agencies did. And that's what the government has funded. We had incredible preparation leading up to this season, because we knew that this was going to be a difficult and challenging season.
Vicky Ward, Victoria's Minister for Emergency Services and Natural Disaster Recovery. And staying with the Victorian bushfires, on Sunday afternoon, residents in Natimuck were finally able to return to their community after fire tore through the region, destroying around 30 homes and 40 sheds. Horsham Deputy Mayor Bec Sluggett lives in nearby Pimpinio. She evacuated her two teenage children on Friday morning before she and her husband returned to fight the fire with the local CFA. Jade spoke with her.
How are you and how are your family doing in the wake of this?
It's been really hard, and I think at some point in the near future there'll be a call for a cup of tea and a few tears.
Can you describe what conditions were like at the time? We've heard that this fire just moved so quickly.
The conditions were scary. Even before we knew there was a fire, the wind itself, and I must admit I'm a bit nervous around wind anyway, but the wind itself was really, really horrible. It was extremely windy. Visibility was already pretty bad because of the level of dust in the air. And I mean, all morning we could hear, we've got quite a few big trees behind our house, even though they're a little distance off, and we could hear things from the trees hitting the roof of the house. Having been through fire before, we were very anxious about fire starting because we knew the conditions meant that it was going to be extremely horrible fire. And unfortunately, it didn't take long from when the first alert came through to when alert after alert was coming through, and more people were warned that they were likely to be impacted. It hit home very quickly that it was going to be bad.
People from Nadimuk, I think, have been allowed to return to their homes now. Have residents of Kwantong, another affected area, have they been able to go back in yet?
I'm not entirely sure, although the latest Watch and Act on the Vic Emergency website does note that roads east of the Wimmera River in the Kwantong Vectus area were open from 7 p.m. Last night. However, I do note that the Vic Traffic website still has a few roads closed, so I believe Kwantong, but that's unconfirmed. I'd have to confirm that this morning, or I would encourage people to confirm that before moving into the area.
And what kind of support is being provided to these communities at the moment? We know from other disasters across the country that it can be a really long road to recovery. How important is that support and I suppose the community coming together going to be in the weeks, months, years ahead?
It's going to be a long road. And I know from the Black Saturday fires that we had here in Horsham and fires that our family were impacted by in 2006 that there's still things that haven't been replaced. You end up with a new normal. Things don't go back to how they were pre-fire. But one thing we have in the Nadimuk and Horsham region is an extremely strong community that really rally together in times of crisis. And even at the, it was extremely emotional at the information session in Horsham, but it was so pleasing to see the community all leaning and supporting each other, and that is going to be so, so important. Council this morning will be setting up a recovery hub in the main street of Nadimuk. That'll be open from 10 through to 4 each day, and there's no plan on when that will close. That will remain open for as long as the community need it. And we really, really call the community to come forward and register with that so that, and let us know as you know what they are, what your needs are, so that we can connect you with the relevant people, government bodies, community organisations and things that will be able to deliver the support that people require.
Horsham Deputy Mayor Bex Luggett. And you can stay across the latest warnings for your local area through your local ABC radio station. Turning overseas now, and authorities in Iran say they could intensify their crackdown on the biggest anti-government protests in years, blaming what they call terrorists and vowing to protect the Islamic regime. One human rights group says at least 192 protesters have died since the demonstrations began 2 weeks ago, amid warnings the actual death toll could be several hundred. US President Donald Trump has again warned he could intervene, saying America stands ready to help, as reports of violence and an internet blackout make the situation hard to verify. For more on this, Jake spoke with Greg Karlstrom. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Economist based in Riyadh.
The New York Times is reporting that President Trump has been briefed on military strike options against Iran if the crackdown continues. How seriously do you think that's being taken inside Iran right now, particularly by the leadership?
I mean, I think they're taking these threats seriously, based on experience. You know, they remember what happened last summer when Trump spent several months issuing threats to the regime around nuclear negotiations. Those negotiations went nowhere, and then he ultimately followed through on those threats and carried out airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. So there is precedent here for Donald Trump making good on threats that he makes towards the Iranians. But I think the question is, you know, what exactly is he planning? It was one thing over the summer to carry out this discreet one-off strike against a very particular target, the nuclear sites. It's another thing to promise to rescue protesters from the regime, to protect them from being attacked by the regime. What that means in practice, I think, is a lot murkier.
Yeah, what kind of options do you think Donald Trump could be considering here?
I mean, there's a menu of options ranging from, if you're talking military options, a symbolic strike on one end of the spectrum, which I think would be largely ineffective and might end up being counterproductive because it would show that he's not actually planning to rescue the protesters, as he says. And then it could be something more concerted, a more extensive campaign of strikes against the Revolutionary Guard, all the way up to perhaps an effort at decapitating the regime, at taking out senior members of the Revolutionary Guard, perhaps targeting the Supreme Leader himself. I'm sure any of those things are on the menu of military options that have been presented. But then I think what's also being considered, and perhaps being considered more seriously right now, are non-military options, things like using cyber attacks to prevent Iran from shutting off the internet, as it's done over the past few days, trying to target computer systems used by the Revolutionary Guard and other security forces. Those might be the sorts of things the Americans at least start with, rather than immediately jumping to military strikes.
Just how big are these protests inside Iran at the moment? How do they compare to previous protest movements of 2022 and even 2009?
We don't know right now because of this communications blackout. There are fragmentary bits of information, videos, stories that are coming out of Iran, but it's very hard to have a comprehensive picture of the unrest. But I think what we can say with certainty is the protests have grown a lot over the past few days since Thursday night. That was really the first night when we saw large-scale nationwide protests. I've spoken to some people who think we're now talking about a bigger uprising than in 2022. There are some Iranian analysts who are even comparing it to those major protests in 2009 that followed a stolen election back then. And then I think the intensity of the crackdown, the violence from the regime, is also some of the worst that we've seen. The official confirmed death toll from human rights groups is still in the hundreds, but even they acknowledge that is probably an undercount. And stories that are coming out of hospitals overrun by gunshot victims, morgues overflowing with bodies, it sounds as if the death toll is indeed quite high.
These protests began over economic issues. How have they evolved since then, and what is now driving people onto the streets despite these obvious risks?
I think what's driving people is just an overarching sense that the regime has no answer for any of the existential problems that are facing the country. Economic concerns are a big part of it. The currency has lost 50% of its value just in the past year. Inflation is running above 40%. People are really struggling at this point to pay for food and medicine and other basic essentials in Iran. That's one piece of it. Another piece of it is environmental crisis, which is getting worse and worse to the point where a couple of months ago in November, there were real concerns that Tehran was going to run out of water, but the capital might have to be evacuated because there would not be water for millions of people in Tehran. And then you add to that the war with Israel over the summer, the possibility of another conflict that is still looming. There's a feeling that there are all of these interlocking crises in Iran right now. And again, the government just has no solutions for any of them.
Greg Karlstrom, a Middle East correspondent for The Economist. I'm going to take you back home now and to South Australia, where doubts are growing over the future of Adelaide's Writers Festival as withdrawals mount following the removal of Palestinian-Australian author Runda Abdul Fattah from the program. The latest departures include three board members who reportedly resigned after an extraordinary board meeting over the weekend. Last week, former Adelaide Festival leaders signed an open letter urging the board to reinstate Abdul Fattah. The signatories to that letter included former Adelaide Writers' Week director, Joe Dyer. Jade started this interview by asking the former director what she knew about that reported meeting over the weekend.
Well, it was a crisis meeting because Adelaide Writers' Week and the festival more broadly is clearly now in complete crisis. The program was due to go to print this week. At the moment, the numbers of authors that have withdrawn are approaching 100. There really is, at the moment, not a viable Writers' Week program. The board got together on Saturday and had a very long meeting to discuss whether or not to reverse the really quite extraordinary extraordinary decision that they had taken earlier that week to disinvite Dr. Abdel Fattah, who had been invited by Louise Adler to be part of a program that had subsequently been approved by the board. At the end of that meeting, the decision was taken, in what I understand was a split decision, not to rescind their earlier decision, and as a result, three board members resigned. Of course, later, the chair of the board has subsequently also resigned, which is unsurprising, really. She was tasked with the responsibility under the Festival Corporations Act to continue and further develop the Adelaide Festival of Arts as an event of international standing and excellence, and yet had overseen a decision which has trashed the international standing of what is one of the most beloved organisations in Adelaide.
So where does this leave the board now practically? Can it continue to operate?
No. I mean, it no longer has a quorum. There's only three voting members left on the board, and this is mere weeks out from when the festival, the Adelaide Festival itself, as well as Writers' Week, is due to take place. I mean, the Premier of South Australia, I would have to say, has been criminally negligent in the way that he has approached Writers' Week. He had brought really unbearable pressure on the board to rescind the invitation to Dr. Abdel Fattah in a way which is completely inappropriate for him to do. Yes, as he keeps saying, by law he can't direct the board to do anything, but he appoints the board members, his government funds the organisation. Clearly it puts the board in an invidious position. To their discredit, they were not able to withstand that pressure as they should have. But now we don't have a functioning organisation, and it is the people of Adelaide and South Australia who are the victims of this debacle.
You mentioned the South Australian Premier there, Peter Malinauskas. We have a snippet of what he's had to say on this issue.
But on the 6th of February in 2024, Dr. Rundle Abdel Fattah wrote to the Adelaide Festival Board advocating for the removal of a pro-Israeli speaker in 2024, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Thomas Friedman. Mr. Friedman wrote an article that was deemed to be offensive to the Palestinian community. Dr. Rundle Abdel Fattah advocated for his removal from the Adelaide Writers' Week program in 2024. And in that instance, the board made a decision to remove that pro-Israeli speaker. Fast forward to where we are today, and now Dr. Abdel Fattah finds herself to the same times of advocacy against her. And I think for some good reason.
Now, I believe that a scheduling issue was cited as the reason that that author in question didn't end up appearing at that year's festival. But what do you make of that argument from the South Australian Premier?
I reject it completely. I mean, the thing is every citizen has a right to petition any organisation as to who should be included or excluded. The issue here is the board has taken a decision to disinvite someone because of pressure from the government, because of, it appears, the politics, if not the nationality, of the author in question, and fears about what she may or may not say. It's how an organisation responds to that pressure and whether or not it stands firm as a protector of the freedom of artistic expression. Now, in 2024, the board did. There's a letter circulating that says, we believe that our reputation as being protector of freedom of expression is important. We don't disinvite authors. That would be an extreme action to take. I mean, back in 2023, Premier Malinauskas himself said there is a profound responsibility of governments to ensure freedom of speech is not compromised by cancel culture. Every time something bobs up, we may disagree with. I mean, he himself said that the whole idea of Writers' Week is to hear other perspectives. So particularly if we don't like them. And that is what Writers' Week has always been about and has always done in a remarkable way. It is a site of civic exchange of great importance to the people of Adelaide, and Adelaide is known internationally as a result of this fantastic event, unique in the world because it is completely free and therefore completely accessible for everybody to attend. Now, there is this specious attempt to conflate what happened with Thomas Friedman with this situation. It is not the same, and there has no evidence whatsoever that the board in the end disinvited Thomas Friedman. And that's what the point is here, that as a result of political pressure, a board buckled and trashed the reputation of an organisation that they themselves know and which they have a legal obligation to try and protect as an event of international standing. It is going to be a very difficult few weeks for the team that have been working so hard to put together a great program for the people of Adelaide and this country under the leadership of a new artistic director, Matt Lutton. Everyone was so excited. Everyone had been working so hard for this. Sales had been strong. To now have to keep going and try and get the message about the arts through while this controversy is swirling, it is very difficult. It is a debacle. And in language that Premier Mananauskas would understand, it is the most spectacular own goal that I have witnessed in my time working in the arts.
Jo Dyer is a former Adelaide Writers Week director, and we invited someone from the Adelaide Festival to join us this morning. They declined.
Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Jade McMillan and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Scott. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back with The Wrap the same time tomorrow.